Now, I'd like to share a story with you, which it may even be a true story, but I can't validate that, but it serves our purpose. And it's an event happened in a care home. There was an elderly resident who was getting very low and depressed and distressed to the point that he was threatening to harm himself. And the staff were getting really, really concerned, and they called the doctor. So the doctor came out and sat with him and got some of the staff around and said, "Well, what have you been saying to him?" He said, "Well, we've been trying to reassure him that he does matter, that he does have value, that he is important to us." And so the doctor said to the pressman, said, "Yes, but why does he matter? Why is he important? Why does he have value?" And they couldn't answer. You know, it's one of those sort of phrases we tend to use. Anyway, eventually, one of the nurses there sort of gingerly put a hand up and said, "Because he's made in the image of God. That's why." So now some of you may remember, and perhaps you were concerned at the reading, thinking, "Well, this is a passage I spoke on a few months ago on God as creator." But I want to follow up this evening to focus specifically on the creator of man. And when the Bible says man, it means mankind, so men and women. And especially on this theme of man being made in the image and likeness of God. So that's where I want to go. So what does it mean? Why is it important for us to understand it? And why does it give all people real value and dignity? Now, to give some direction, partly for me, we're going to look at three themes. Something remarkable, a great reversal, and fully renewed. Okay, so something remarkable, a great reversal, and fully renewed. Now, coming to the first point, it's a remarkable thing that man is made in God's own image. Okay, the Bible doesn't actually refer to it very often, but it is hugely significant for us to understand the identity of mankind and what God has said. Okay, now, as we've read, and the reason for reading the whole passage there is that we see that all the other creatures were made according to their likeness, but man is made, as God and the Godhead says, in our image, in our likeness. Now, we might have a lot of thoughts about, well, what does that mean? And what does it look like for us to bear the image of God? And thoughts we may have, and you can share more, is, I think, the ability to think and to be able to reason, to have imagination, to be creative. Perhaps more importantly, to be able to relate, that's not just to God, but to each other. To understand right and wrong and have a sense of morality. And I'd say that all those ideas are totally valid and are sort of indicative of what it means to be human. But if we look closely at what the Bible actually says here in Genesis in 1 and 26, 27, it's saying that we're made to rule or govern, to subdue the earth and rule over the other creatures. So thinking about what that looks like, a word I don't think I've heard for a very long time but could be used here is viceroy. A viceroy is a person appointed to rule a region as a representative or a deputy. But the thing about being a viceroy, not just someone who's given the job, a viceroy doesn't govern on his own sort of whim and character. But he mirrors, or she mirrors, what it would be like if the sovereign they represent was actually there ruling in person. In other words, it's they copy or they would emulate exactly what their sovereign would be. So that's what a viceroy is. So similarly, it isn't God saying to man, "I've made this world for you, go and do what you like with it," but we're to image or reflect the Lord's nature in that governance, okay? So I would suggest the characteristics of fairness, of goodness, of love and justice. In other words, we're meant to mirror God's character in that governance. So we see that humankind, or mankind, was made in the image of God to rule. But a very interesting observation that I've read by Matthew Henry, I'm sure you've heard of Matthew Henry's commentary, is this, and I'm going to put it on the screen. Very happy to credit Matthew Henry with these words. Speaking of man, his government of himself, that's man, by the freedom of his will, has in it more of God's image than his government of the creatures. I think it's a very interesting phrase. His government of himself, by the freedom of his will, has in it more of God's image than his government of creation. I think this is what distinguishes us from all other creatures. To illustrate that, don't we say, or perhaps we've heard, when there's been a particularly heinous or ghastly crime, I've heard this a few times, a judge in their summing up says that the behaviour was animal-like. And what we mean by that, isn't it, that it was without restraint, that the restraint that we would expect a human being to apply to themselves. Now, an animal acts as a predator or on a sort of biological impulse, but humans would ordinarily be expected to have the characteristics of understanding what violence is, of respecting the life of another, and of having a moral conscience. So how close is this image, it's how we're imaged to God? So what I want to attempt to do this evening is try to get a deeper sense of what it means to be, for us to be made in the image and likeness of our Creator God. Now, I'm going to change tack slightly here, not want to confuse things, but I think it's interesting to consider for a moment the second commandment. Second commandment, you shall not make an image. And yet we understand that God has made mankind in his own image, in his own likeness. So how does that work together? So I think that suggests there's something very profound here, that it singles mankind solely out as bearing God's image. And that's something that God defends and guards very jealously. So to understand how that works, how do we have that second commandment and yet God has already made man in his own image? What I'd like to do is look at the original Hebrew word used in Genesis 1:26 for image. And that word is Selem. I'm pretty sure that's how you pronounce Selem. Now, Selem, that's the word here. Selem is most commonly used to refer to a physical statue of stone or wood. And it's usually translated in the Bible as idol or statue. So I know this is feeling a bit uncomfortable, but don't kill the mic or kick me out. Just bear with me. Now, to illustrate further why that would work, where else does this word appear? Now, interestingly, we're working through Numbers in our morning service at the moment, and I'm going to jump ahead to Numbers 33. So sorry to steal anyone's thunder there, but this is what it says in Numbers 33. Speak to the Israelites, say to them, when you cross the Jordan into Canaan, drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you. Destroy all their carved images and their cast idols and demolish all their high places. That word idols there is Selem. Okay. I say, maybe we're beginning to feel a little bit uncomfortable with the concept, but just to give some more context here, in my research for tonight, in a roundabout way, I came across two Hebrew scholars, and they both make the point that in Near Eastern religion, it was understood that idols were set up to be the real presence of the deity or the god that they represented. It was believed that the god or deity was really inhabited the image. Okay, so just have that in mind. And in fact, there's examples of statues were often painted and dressed, we might think like a mannequin. Now, I'm sure like me, you've wondered just how those who fashioned idols and statues out of metal or wood or stone with their own hands could then revere and worship them. It just doesn't... I've often think that. Think about the golden calf. They made it themselves. And then they said they got up the next morning and bowed down and worshipped it and said that calf had rescued them from Egypt. How? But it just shows that what those scholars are saying, that was the culture. They really believed the deity their gods, their idols and statues represented were inhabited by the deity. So imagine, therefore, being one of those original readers hearing this, that God is saying that he made God in his own Selem, in his own image. Okay, so it gives you something of the impact and the significance of being made in his image. Now, I must say, of course, that the Bible clearly condemns worship of any kind to an idol or a statue. And it does express the futility and the powerlessness of man-made images. So it's in line with how I do feel. An example is Psalm 115. It says this: idols made by human hands have eyes but cannot see, have mouths but cannot speak, ears but cannot hear, noses but cannot smell, hands that cannot feel, feet that cannot walk. You can't make it a lot clearer. Okay, so I'm not saying these... So that's what God says about these idols. And it's interesting, in the original tabernacle, they weren't to put any images or idols or statues in them. They were to be clear or anything like that. So how do we reconcile that second commandment with the Tselem of man-made in God's image? Well, one of those scholars, called Nair, phrases it like this. He says, there's no need of a divine image because humans represent Yahweh as a statue would have done. Again, the language sounds unusual, but stay with me. In other words, I could put it this way, and if I can express it this way, we are called to be the living idols. Okay, the word Tselem, the living idols. Again, say the language. It'd be pointless to make another idol. You're making an idol effectively of an idol. Okay, so we're to be that living image of God. Okay. Again, I've been looking at this for about 3 or 4 weeks, and it sort of feels uncomfortable language, doesn't it? But I'm looking at the vocabulary, trying to get the impact of what it meant for God to be, for us to be made in his image. And I think what we should just take from it is this, that being made in the image of our Creator is a deep and very significant matter. I think that's what we take from it, okay? And we are to image or reflect the Lord, be his viceroys or his representatives of his blessing here on earth. Okay. Now, curiously, last Sunday morning, Simon Roos took the all-age section of the morning service, and he was saying that Christians are, in a sense, the fifth gospel, signposting to others what God is like. So I rang him in the week and said, really interesting you said that, because something I wanted to say tonight is that I think mankind is the most tangible and visible expression of what the Lord is like. So in the world today, it's man that is the most tangible expression. So again, that sort of, don't like to use the word idol, but use the word image. We're the most tangible expression, okay? So we can see that it's remarkable that in all of creation, the holy Creator God should elect to make you and me in his image and his likeness. And something else that's remarkable is that it's true of all human beings have this status and bear his image. Now, I think we have to recognize, of course, although it's true that his image is in us, but it's true that that image has been marred or spoilt or hindered by the fall and by sin. But it is still right that we regard and respect all people as being made in the image of God. And sometimes that's very hard. Our minds tend to immediately go to some of the sort of notable dictators in history or those that instigated the Holocaust and so on. And we think, how can we see the image of God in them? Or perhaps we might think of some of the those of convicted in crimes in our modern day, of crimes we find horrific and ghastly and terrible. We think, how can we see the image of God in them? Or maybe perhaps on a more everyday level, we may have some sort of sense of bias towards people without willingly, but maybe a youth in a hoodie loitering a bit suspiciously, trying to hide his face, and what's he up to? Is he going to be a threat to me? Maybe a beggar on the street looking for money, and you get near him and you see beer cans behind him, and you think, well, why doesn't he? Well, maybe for me, in my work, occasionally we had events where we had to host and entertain customers, and a couple of them were these comedy clubs. I can tell you, I was so cringing with the crudeness and the debaseness of what they were saying about people. And they called that, you know, so-called humour. And all the people around me are laughing. You think, how does that image, the holy God, how is God's holy nature reflected there? And yet, the Bible's clearly saying that all people are made in God's image. So we might ask then, did man lose that inherent image because of the fall, because of the entrance of sin into their lives? But I found a couple of pointers which I think indicate that despite sin entering mankind, man doesn't actually lose God's image. And here's the first one to show you. This is from Genesis 9. So remember, this is after the fall. Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made mankind. So that's the mandate for not harming or murdering. You don't murder someone else or harm someone else because they're made in God's image. So that's after the fall. What about this one from the New Testament? With the tongue, we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse human beings who have been made in God's likeness. So this is way into the Bible, into the New Testament. So it's telling us that we must regard all people as being made in God's likeness. So seeing all people in this light, how does that affect our attitude and our behaviour towards each other or to anyone we meet in just in the normal course of our daily lives? I'll look at that a bit more closely about how it affects our character and behaviour. But for now, looked at remarkable. We're going to move to our next theme, which is reversal. Now, I've commented on sin sort of hindering or maybe hiding God's likeness in us, but not completely losing his image. And I think it could be a little bit like this. This is Jedburgh Abbey. It's quite a nice picture, so it looks quite good there. But if you get to it, and I've been past this many times, it's actually in semi-ruin. The roof is missing, all the windows are gone, and so on. But it's instantly recognisable. I know that's Jedburgh Abbey, and people know it hasn't lost its original identity. But what about this one? This is a car in a very dilapidated state, and I'm sure many of you, like me, recognise. You can still see instantly that it's a Jaguar. So it's nothing like its former state or glory or the image that it should have had. But it's still instantly recognisable as, well, that's a Jaguar. Now, the Abbey and the car need restoration. So what is needed to restore us and all people to clearly bear God's image? Well, the answer has to be the work of Jesus. Okay. And looking at that, Philippians 2:7 says this, that he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. Okay. Now, Romans 8:3 puts it a lot stronger. It says, God sent his son in the likeness of sinful flesh. Just consider that. The Holy Son of God appearing in the likeness of sinful flesh. It almost sounds blasphemous, doesn't it? It's certainly sort of, how could you say that about the Son of God? But this is what I mean about this reversal. Man was made in the image of God, and now we see the Son of God, or Son of Man, appearing in man's image. Now, I think that's an amazing, amazing consideration. Now, we've considered it remarkable that man has been created in God's image. But maybe even more remarkable is that the very Son of God should appear in man's image, in the likeness of sinful flesh. Now, maybe younger children in Sunday school, we teach them that Jesus left all the glories and wonder of heaven to mix with us in this broken and dirty world. But I don't think that gives the full picture. The Bible describes Jesus as a great high priest. The high priest dwells amongst or alongside his people, experiences all that they experience, live in their shoes, as it were, and then does all that is needed to be bring reconciliation and restoration. And Hebrews summarizes it like this. I read this to you. For this reason, he had to be made like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. Now, I think that's probably the most wonderful thing we could ever tell anybody, that Jesus became fully human in every way. He might become a merciful and faithful high priest, that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. And what it's saying is that he didn't just visit us and dwell amongst us, but actually took on flesh so that he could be that sacrifice of atonement. So it's not just left the comfort of heaven, came to this the slums of this world, but became one of us. So there's that great sort of reversal. So having looked at that, we come to our final theme, which is renewal. Now, renewal is the change and the effect on all who accept that restoring work of Jesus. And I've now said this before, but I think the Christian life is primarily about having the image of God restored in us. It's not first and foremost us being forgiven for our sins. That's essential for us to take that step. But I think the purpose is that we then become those viceroys. We then become restored to our original state. We then become back to what God made us to be in the first place. And to illustrate this, Colossians describes it in terms of putting on a new self. Do not lie to each other, since you have taken off your old self with its practices and put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. I think it's very interesting language, isn't it? It's saying that's the purpose. You know, we put on this new self so that we image our creator. Ephesians says this: put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. So what does that look like in our lives now? What's that like in the lives of the believer? Well, one commentator I read puts it like this: the standard for the believer in Christ is no less than the standard God set for himself at the creation, no less than his own likeness. I think what's implying is if God's made us in his likeness, he's expecting us to be like him. And your minds might have already shot to Matthew 5, be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Okay? So that's the standard. But what does this renewal and taking on this new self actually look like in practice? Well, some Bible verses can be very familiar, but if you consider them carefully, they can actually be quite challenging. And here's one, 1 John 4:20. If you can't love your brother who you can see, how can you love God who you can't see? Okay. Now, I don't know about you, but I think that can be quite hard sometimes, and particularly, you know, perhaps for my brothers and sisters, you know, where we feel disappointed or irritated by people, or maybe we feel prone to criticize things or to be jealous, or sometimes things are hard to forgive. We might yearn to know more of the love of God. We might come to church. We might join in all the worship and all those good things. But I think the harmony and the fellowship between us is the truer reflection of God's image amongst us. It's not how great the singing is or and so on. That's the true reflection. So if we can't love each other, who we can see, how can we say that we love God? So I think imaging God has to be love, doesn't it? Because God is love. Okay. But another final thought on that work of renewal in this is what does it again look like in our daily lives? And I'd like to slip back here to this concept of being like this living idol. Deuteronomy 4:20 has some really interesting language. I thought it was quite curious. As for you, the Lord took you and brought you out of the iron smelting furnace out of Egypt to be the people of his inheritance as you now are. And what was an iron smelting furnace used for? There's something that's interesting phrasing there. It's suggesting that but God used that work, that occasion in their lives to that hardship to fashion them to be his people. Now similarly, in the New Testament, the Christian experience is often describes hardship as God's discipline, which produces a harvest of righteousness and peace, it says. So on that idea of the furnace and so on, I wanted to finish on the idea of being refined. We sing that, don't we? Refine as fire and so on. Now, I referred earlier to our current studies in Numbers. But another book which we explored recently was Malachi. I'd like to pick out just a small portion of a verse in Malachi 3. It says, he will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. He will purify the Levites and refine them like gold and silver. Then the Lord will have men who will bring offerings in righteousness. Now, I heard recently of a men's Bible study. It's not people that we know. But they were looking at this verse, And they wondered, what does a silver refiner do? Why this sitting as a refiner? Why that phrase? What does that mean? So one of them, this is true, okay, one of them went to find a silversmith and asked them about their work. And one thing they asked them was, do you really have to sit there? Don't you just heat up the silver, leave it for a while, and come back? So no, we have to watch it very carefully. We're watching the impurities coming, but the important thing is we mustn't overheat it because that will spoil the silver. So we have to watch very carefully. And of course, they ask the question, when do you know it's pure? And he said, that's easy, when I can see my image in it. I find that very moving. So doesn't that just give you a sense of the Lord's design and plan for us, that he wants to see his image in us? And that refining, he won't over-discipline us, he won't harm us, but it'll be enough just to make us pure, that once again he can see his image incredibly, wonderfully in you and even me. So I'll leave that final thought with you.